Already, I have told you all of the new content and formalism that I wanted to tell you about in this course. And so today, we're not going to introduce any new formalism, but what I'm going to do is review the concept map that you saw at the beginning of the course. And now hopefully you will see how much more you know than you knew before, because hopefully the map will make more sense than it did at the beginning of the course. And then after that, I will go through an example of a situation where you can use all of this formalism to solve a problem that probably you wouldn't be able to solve without the formalism. And I will show you how you can use these generalized measurements and CPTP maps to implement something better than you could do just using projective measurements. So yeah, let's first start with the map. So everything we've been doing, we've been dividing into preparations, transformations, and measurements. And we had two sets of postulates corresponding to those three operations. So the first was the ideal set of postulates, and the second one was the realistic set of postulates. So in the ideal case, we said that preparations are given by this pure state psi. And we could actually write it as a density matrix or density operator if we want, just by taking the outer product of these states. And these two descriptions are equivalent. For transformations, we had unitary operators, and the way that they evolved our state was as follows. And hidden inside the structure of the unitary is information about how the system evolves in terms of the Hamiltonian, but we haven't really been dealing with Hamiltonians explicitly. We were just considering the general structure of unitaries. And if we wanted to do this in the density matrix picture, or density operator picture, we could say that psi prime, the outer product of that is given like that. And then finally, when it came to measurements were described by a set of projectors PM. And we could do two things here. So the postulate told us what is the probability of getting outcome M, which we could write as probability M is given in terms of the Born rule. And then we could also write down the state of the system after getting an outcome M. So we had the post-measurement state was given by the projector PM acting on the state, the initial state, divided by the square root of the probability of getting outcome M. And if I had more space, I could write the equivalent formulation of that in terms of the density matrix, but everything would just be a case of taking the conjugate transpose of that and then sticking it on the other side, the same way that we did here. Okay, and then when it came to the realistic postulates, we said that now we necessarily have to describe our state with a density operator. And in general, this density operator can be decomposed into what's called a probabilistic mixture or a statistical mixture of pure states, psi I. And these pure states don't necessarily need to be orthogonal. And we can interpret this type of state as saying that I prepare the, we can interpret this density matrix as being I prepare the pure state psi I with probability pi. Then for realistic transformations, we had a set of completely positive trace preserving maps. And so these maps could be written in terms of a decomposition called the Krauss decomposition. So we could say the density operator after the transformation is given by applying the map to the input state, and then we can sum over a set of Krauss operators. And then when it came to the generalized measurement, which was given in terms of these POVMs, we could write down an equivalent Born rule for the probability of getting outcome M as being the trace of the density operator with one of the POVM elements EM. And we can also write down a state update rule to say that given outcome M, our post-measurement state is going to be rho M, which in general I can write in terms of these. I'm being a little bit sloppy because here I didn't include the subscripts I, but let's keep them here. Okay, so that's the generalized state update rule. So maybe if we were careful, I should include this sum over I here. Okay, and as you guys already saw at the beginning, you guessed that given this set of postulates, you can recover those postulates just by taking a special case of these ones. So we can see that if we assume that there is just a single term in this decomposition, then we can recover the ideal postulate. So we can go in this direction. So if rho is just one of these, we get the ideal ones. And similarly here, we can go in this direction. If we only have one term in this decomposition, then AK will be a unitary and we'll get this ideal postulate out. And then same for the measurements. If our POVM elements are projectors, then we recover the ideal case. So that should be pretty clear, but maybe what wasn't obvious and what we saw yesterday was that you can actually go in the other direction. So given this set of ideal operations, if you act the ideal ones on a larger dimensional Hilbert space and then just look at the reduced action on one of the subsystems, then we get this effective description here. So to go in this direction, we would say that rho A is the partial trace over system B of some pure state on a composite system AB. And then if we want to go in that direction for the transformations, then we can say that the CPTP map on system A is given by preparing system A and introducing an auxiliary system B. Then acting a entangling unitary, or potentially entangling unitary, on both of those systems, so system A and B, and then tracing out system B. So, and we saw that by doing this, we could then rewrite this in terms of these Krauss operators, where the Krauss operators actually depended on this auxiliary input state and the form of this unitary. And then to go in the other direction for measurement, we saw that in order to figure out the Born rule, to derive the Born rule corresponding to a POVM, so the probability of getting outcome M, we would prepare our state rho A, introduce some auxiliary system rho B, then apply some unitary to both of them. Okay, the same way that we did for the transformations, but now there's an extra step where we want to do a measurement on system B. So we now act the identity on system A, do a projective measurement on system B, and then we take the partial trace over system B. And this thing sorry, my writing is kind of terrible here, but hopefully you can see what's going on. That we have system A and B, then we apply unitary to both systems, and then we project on system B, and then that gives us the probability of outcome N. And you can do the same thing for the state update rule, but it gets quite messy and we didn't actually do it. But by doing this, you can then find an expression for these POVMs, or even the measurement operators, in terms of the state of the auxiliary system, the unitary AB, and which choice of projective measurement you made. Yes?
An example where we use the state update rule for in the realistic case, like how we constructed these MMs. They have to satisfy that EM equals MM dagger MM, right? The sum over,
mm-hmm.
right? Have we not? Because I have no intuition on how to build those MMs.
Yeah. So yesterday we looked at something. Did we actually derive it? So I started at the end to go through this weak measurement, and there I kind of set it up, but I didn't tell you in the end what these EMs are. And so maybe we have time to do it. So what I was going to do is just use the result from yesterday, but it might be worthwhile to just look at it again and see explicitly how we get these EMs. So
these M's.
Yeah, how to get the MM.
EMs, I understand.
Yeah. So we can see explicitly how to get these. I think I may have written down how to do it, but not giving you an example. But yeah, we can do the example then. So the question is, do you want me to do it at the end of the quantum control scheme, or do you want me to do it before I introduce the quantum control scheme?
That's too much power for me.
Too much power?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah, I know. It sucks when people ask you. So it just depends whether you're okay with the suspense. So yeah, maybe I'll go through the quantum control scheme and I will use say that we know what these MMs are, and then at the end I will show you how to get them. So that's pretty much the whole course, except some fine details here and there. So we already had one question, but maybe this is a good opportunity for you guys to ask any more general questions about the formalism before I give you this explicit example, which will take, I mean, it's a long example, so it'll take pretty much the whole class. Nope, okay, so we will move on, but you can also ask general questions during the class.
I have a question.
Aha, yes.
So everything we did was pretty much in the finite dimensional setting, right?
Yo! yes.
What would change the infinite dimensional setting? Is it possible to explain like?
Well, in practice, nothing will change. So if you want to use the theory to make predictions about experiments, nothing's going to change. You will just do the obvious. You will just turn sums into integrals, and I think everything just works out like as you would expect intuitively. But in order to understand what's going on behind the scenes, I think you need to be very careful and know a lot more about measure theory, which is something it's not my area of expertise. So in practice, I do quantum optics, where one of the things one of the areas of research that I'm interested in is spectral shaping of entangled photons. And so there I'm dealing with continuous systems all the time, the spectrum. And I'm just doing all of this stuff in the continuous case, and it's fine. Like, it doesn't, in practice, you don't have any strange problems. But I think if you were caring about extending quantum theory to some sort of post-quantum theory and wanting to, you know, understand what's going on underneath, I think you need to be careful. And I just, yeah, I can't tell you what you need to be careful about. Yeah. But I can give you some references later. I know there's a professor in IQC, Joseph Emerson, that has thought about this a lot more. And I'm sure I have like a list of references from him to, yeah, if you want to look into it more. Yeah, but sorry that I don't have too much to say about it. Okay. So let's talk about quantum control. So maybe let me just kind of set up to give you an idea of how control typically works. And this is a very hand-wavy explanation, but in many situations in life, you might be interested in just maintaining the state of something. So for example, if you have an oven and you set it to 450 Fahrenheit and you want it to stay at, I know for some reason in Canada it's metric, but we use Fahrenheit for ovens. I don't understand. But anyway, you set your oven to some temperature and you want it to stay at that temperature, then, I mean, the way that the oven heats up is you have some element, and I think it's just, you know, the element can be on or off. So when it's on, it starts heating it up, and when it gets to a certain temperature, the oven knows about it because there's a thermostat there. It measures the temperature and then, you know, monitors it as the temperature is rising. It reaches a particular temperature and then it tells the element to turn off. And then it goes through the cycle of continuously monitoring the temperature and then making a decision based on the reading whether it should turn the element on or off to maintain kind of roughly a level temperature. Another more intuitive example might be like if you're in the shower and you want the temperature of the water to stay the same, then you're monitoring it because you can feel the temperature on your skin. And if you're in there for a long time because you're stuck thinking about some physics problem or something, eventually the water is going to start running cold and you're going to detect that. And then you're going to act based on your measurement to maybe, you know, turn the cold water down and turn the hot water up so that the temperature remains the same. So the way control usually works is that you monitor a system and then based on the results of the measurements that you're making on the system, you perform some action to either correct what went wrong or maybe, you know, do something else to steer the system in the direction that you're interested in. And so this works fine in classical systems because you can just measure a classical system and learn information about it. But if you're trying to control a quantum system, then you have a problem because as soon as you measure it, you're going to, like if you perform a projective measurement, you're going to collapse the state into some state corresponding to the basis in which you measured. So when it comes to quantum control, you have to rethink your strategies. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. I'll discuss a particular strategy for controlling a very specific kind of system. Okay, so what is the scenario? So our task is that we want to protect a set of two non-orthogonal qubits from noise. So consider that we have two qubits, consider that you have one of two qubits. Okay, and so we can draw these states on the block sphere just to help us visualize things. And I'm drawing the block sphere slightly differently to how I've been drawing. So I'm now going to put the x-axis here. So this is the plus state. And this will be the minus. Okay, and so these two particular states, they will lie here. I wish I had a little bit of color. And they have an angle from this axis of theta. So we can calculate the overlap between these two states. Okay, and so for theta equals pi on 2, these states will be completely orthogonal. They'll be the 0 and 1 state, so they'll be distinguishable. And for theta equals 0, then they're going to be exactly the same state, so they won't be distinguishable at all. And so the distinguishability between these two states increases as theta increases. And we can see that schematically on the block sphere. Okay, so the situation is that for whatever reason, we want to send one of these two states from me to somebody else across some quantum channel. And the person who is implementing the control procedure does not know, or the device that's implementing the control procedure doesn't know whether it was this state that was sent or that state. So they need to have a procedure that will work independent of which state it is. And so the way that it's going to work is that we're going to prepare one of the states, one or two. It's then going to experience some noise. And then what we want to do is develop a procedure to kind of undo the effect of this noise. So we're going to have some kind of measurement. And then that measurement is going to give us a classical output. So if it's a binary measurement, then it might give us a 0 and a 1. So let's say it outputs 0, 1. And then based on that measurement, we're going to have a conditional operation acting on that state. So we'll call this the thing that fixes it. And then what will come out most likely is going to be some mixed state. If the procedure was perfect, then what would come out would be a pure state, but in general it'll be some mixed state. But hopefully this state is going to be closer to what we put in than it would be just after the noise. So let's just define this as the control procedure. And so after we've implemented some kind of control procedure, we want to know how well it worked. And so then what we're going to do is to just compare the input and output states. And there are various ways that you can do it, but one thing you can do is compute the fidelity between these two states. So that's something you guys looked at, I believe, in tutorial 2. The last question had had you computing some fidelity between states. Okay, so that's the general procedure. So in order to come up with a control strategy, you probably would like to know something about the noise that your channel is experiencing. So in this particular case, what we're going to do is consider a specific kind of noise which you've already encountered, and it's called dephasing noise. You didn't see it by this name, you saw it as a phase flip channel, but it also goes by the name dephasing because okay, let me write down the map first, and then I'll explain why it goes by the name dephasing. So if you recall the phase flip channel with probability P, it's going to apply a sigma z rotation, and with probability 1 minus p, it'll do nothing to the state. So you can imagine what's happening to this state if it undergoes this this type of noise. So with some probability, it'll be flipped to that the state here, and this guy with some probability will be flipped to that state there. With 1 minus p, it'll stay as one of these two states. And so then the final states will lie somewhere along this line. So I now have like too many lines that I'm drawing on here. But the, let's say the final state after applying the noise is somewhere here. Then it's going to have less coherence between the plus and the minus state. So I guess the extreme cases is that if it was on the x-axis, on the z-axis, you would just have an incoherent mixture of 0 and 1, while this is the most coherent superposition of the two. And so you can imagine the closer you get to the z-axis, the less coherence you have in your state. And so that's like getting rid of the phase information between the 0 and the 1, which is why it's called dephasing. Okay, so we have, this is our map. We could have written it in terms of Krauss operators, where we have two Krauss operators where one of them is square root of p sigma z, and the other one is square root of 1 minus p identity. So these are equivalent descriptions. Okay, so let's calculate what the output state is after we apply this channel. So I already kind of explained in words how, or in pictures, how it would look. But if we want to actually know what the state is, we can calculate it. So I'm going to kind of do the calculation for both states at the same time, because they essentially have the same form except for a plus and a minus. So here are the states after noise. So row either 1 or 2 is going to be probability P, we apply sigma z to the state 1 or 2. Plus probability 1 minus P So here all I've done is just inserted the state into this map. And then do I want to? Okay, I will just do it. So now I'm going to insert the expressions for psi 1 and 2. Oh, okay, no. Sorry. So I'll just finish writing this line and then I'll explain what's going on. So for the second line, it's kind of easy. All I've done is written out the state psi 1 or 2, outer product of psi 1 or 2, where the 1 or 2 is given by this plus or minus. On the first line, I already applied the sigma z operation. So sigma z takes a 0. What does it do? Right, sigma z takes a 0 to a 0, and it takes a 1 to a minus 1. So if we have something that's a superposition, so 0 plus 1, it's going to go to 0 minus 1. So a sigma z will take a plus state to a minus state, which is why I have a minus here, and a minus state to a plus state, which is why I have a plus here. So essentially, it's the same state, but I've now flipped the phase. And then you can go through and expand this, and you get something kind of messy. Okay, and then what we can do is, I guess you guys have considered, I think you looked at trace distance in one of the questions, but now what we can do is just compute what the trace distance is between these two states just to see what the effect of the noise is on the distinguishability of the states. And maybe I won't go through this calculation in detail, but if you did it, so the trace distance is just a measure of distance between states, so how different they are to each other. And so if you in here inserted the expressions for row and crunched through the math, you would find that you get sine theta, which is independent of P. So the thing that we've learned here, it just gives us a little bit of information about how the noise works, is that even though you can see that the state itself, the two states itself depend on P, the distance between them is going to remain independent of P. So that's just something that characterizes this noise process for us. And it should, it should kind of be intuitively clear here, because as noise is introduced to these states, you can see that they just are going to lie along this line, and then the Euclidean distance between them will remain the same. So the trace distance you can think of as representing the Euclidean distance on the Bloch sphere. Okay, so now we know a little bit of something about the states. So let's think about some control strategies that we could possibly implement. So I'm going to ask you to think about it a little bit. If you, let's say, didn't know anything about quantum mechanics, and you just wanted to use some type of classical strategy that maybe reflected what you would do in a classical system, what's a possible strategy you could use? So the scenario is we start off with these states here. We apply some noise. So perhaps the final states after the noise are somewhere here.
No.
Oh, yeah, sorry, thanks. Good. Row two. Maybe I can draw them on just a projection. That would be easier. Okay. So what we would like is for the thing that comes out to be as close as possible to either this one, if that's what we prepared, and this one, if that's what we prepared. So maybe let me give you a hint. So in a classical control strategy, what you would like to do is measure the system. And based on that information, you would do something that would get the system as close as possible to what you think you measured it to be. So what you might want to do is, let's say, measure in this basis. So we saw yesterday something called the Hellstrom measurement, which was the thing that let us distinguish between these two states as well as possible if you had a projective measurement. So perhaps you could make a Hellstrom measurement, a projective measurement along this basis. And then given outcome zero, you might think, well, let's just throw away whatever that state is and replace it with the pure state psi one. And given outcome one, you'll throw away this state and replace it with that state. So that's one possible strategy you could use, which I say is a classical strategy because it's not doing any particular quantum operations. It's just making a binary measurement. So I measure and then re-prepare the state based on my outcome. So we can see that that's not going to work perfectly, but we can use this as a possible strategy to contrast with some other strategies that we're going to look at later. So let's see what happens if we use that strategy. Okay, so we'll call this our classical strategy. Which is the measure and then re-prepare strategy. Okay, so we saw from the calculation that we did before, I mean, I'm kind of reiterating it, but from the calculation we did before, the distance between the states doesn't change, and they actually move along here. So the Hellstrom measurement that was optimal for these two states is still going to be the same measurement that distinguishes between 0 and 1, because that's the axis about which they have maximal distinguishability. So we will... So step one is measure in the 0, 1 basis. And then step two is if we get the outcome 0, prepare the state psi 1. And if we get outcome 1, then we prepare the state psi 2, which seems like a reasonable thing to try. Okay, so let's, in order to then figure out what the output state is after we implement this strategy, we first need to know what the probabilities of getting these two outcomes are. And so we're going to have four possible probabilities that we can calculate because we have two possible preparations and two possible outcomes. So let's look at the probability of getting outcome 0 given one of these two input states, where rho 1, 2 is this state here. Well, that guy. So we just use Born rule, the Born rule. So we'll have trace 0, 0, probability. So that's the projector acting on the state. Okay, maybe let me not, I'm not going to rewrite it, but I'm inserting that thing in here. And then I get and then if I crunch through that, I get something that is a half, 1 plus or minus sine theta. Okay, so that comes out to be something quite simple. I could similarly calculate the probability of getting outcome 1 given the state rho 1, 2. And if you went through and redid the same calculation, you would find 1 minus plus sine theta. Okay, so now that we have the probabilities, we can calculate what would be the output state if the state going in was psi 1, and then I applied that control strategy, what will be the output state rho 1? So if we compute that, then we can see how close the controlled output is to the input, which is what we wanted. So given input psi 1, what is output after control strategy? Well, what's our strategy? Our strategy is that if I get outcome 0, I will prepare the state psi 1. And if I get outcome 1, I prepare the state psi 2. So the output state is going to be a statistical mixture of those two preparations, weighted by the probabilities of getting those outcomes. So we'll have probability of getting outcome 0 given rho 1, and then I prepare the state psi 1, plus probability of getting outcome 1, rho 1, and I prepare the state psi 2. So that's my rho 1 given the classical control strategy. Which you can already see that it's not going to be working perfectly, because if there's some probability of getting something here is not right. Oh yeah, no, it's okay. Yeah, if given preparation psi 1, if there's some probability of getting outcome 1, then you're going to occasionally prepare the wrong state, not the one that you wanted. And similarly, you can calculate what is the output of the control strategy given preparation psi 1, psi 2, and it'll look like this. With probability 0, you will prepare the state psi 1, and with probability 1, you will prepare the state psi 2. Okay, so what we've done is we started off with one of two possible states. We applied a control strategy and figured out what are the possible output states. And now we want to see how well this control strategy works. And to do that, we're going to compute the average fidelity between the input states and the output states. And the reason we're taking an average is because we don't know which one of the states it is, so we want to know how well it works for one particular input and for the other particular input. So how well does it work? Compute the fidelity, well, average fidelity. So actually, just to remind you, in case you didn't do the bonus question on tutorial 2, but the fidelity is it measures the overlap between states. And given a mixed state and a pure state, then the fidelity is given by, given one of the states is pure and the other one is some mixed state, the fidelity is computed like this. And so fidelity ranges from 0 to 1. And if fidelity equals 0, then they are orthogonal. No, it must be the, oh yeah. If fidelity equals one, they are identical. So in this case, the fidelity is going to be, it's going to parameterize or quantify how well the scheme works. And what we want is for the fidelity to be as close to one as possible. But so I, again, yeah, because we don't have that much time, I'm not going to go through all of the details of this calculation, but I have all the calculation steps in the notes if you want to look at them later. Or you can redo the calculation yourself. But the fidelity, average fidelity, in this case is going to be the overlap between the initial state and final state, weighted by half, plus the overlap between input state psi 2 and output state rho 2. And so to calculate that, you would input, you would input the initial states into here, and you would input these particular states into there, and you would make note of the fact that these states are not orthogonal. So you'll have all of these cross terms, which is what makes the calculation a little bit time consuming to calculate. But fortunately, we calculated the overlap between the states, which is cos theta over there. So you can use that in the calculation. And if you go through the steps, you get a fidelity. That looks like this. Okay, so it's kind of curious that it doesn't depend on the noise, but well, maybe it makes sense because if the noise doesn't change the distinguishability between these two states, then it's not going to change the probabilities of getting the outcomes. So maybe it's not so surprising. Okay, so this was kind of the obvious classical strategy that you could use. And now what our goal is to come up with maybe a different strategy that uses a generalized measurement that can yield a fidelity that's higher than the classical strategy one. Oh, okay, so maybe, okay, so what, yeah. So this classical strategy that we came up with, you can kind of follow what's going on, but it turns out that this classical strategy is not actually the optimal classical strategy. So the optimal classical strategy would be to also do measurement and reprepare, but the state that you reprepare wouldn't be exactly this state. So it turns out that if you prepare a state that's slightly different than this one to kind of counter the fact that you get these probabilities corresponding to the wrong inputs or the probabilities corresponding to the wrong outcomes. Yeah, it turns out you need to prepare some other state and you can actually get an improved classical strategy. So I'm not going to go through those steps, but I will just give you the result because in fact that's a more fair strategy to compare against. So let's call it the optimal classical control strategy. And the fidelity for that is going to be cosine squared theta plus sine 4 theta. And I'll show you some pictures later of what these actually look like, so you'll be able to see how to compare them. Okay, so that's the classical control strategy. And now let's think about a quantum control strategy. So let's say you were doing some research, and that was your research project to come up with some strategy. I mean, you wouldn't you would want to kind of base your strategy on some intuition about what's going on in this scenario. So, well, maybe somehow you could like computationally search over all possible quantum strategies and come up with some strange. Strange set of POVMs and fixes, but that might be a computationally challenging task. So what you would want to do is kind of use your intuition to maybe suggest some possible POVMs that might actually do what you're wanting. Might fix whatever is going on with the qubit when it's affected by noise. And so the intuition that you might use here might be different if you think about the noise as arising from some different physical process, even if it has the same CPTP map. So I've described this dephasing noise as being a phase flip applied with probability P and nothing happening with probability 1 minus p, but you could in fact decompose this map in a different way. So a different decomposition would be as follows. So recall that you can have rotations around different axes in the Bloch sphere. So a rotation about axis J by angle phi will be given as cosine phi on 2 times the identity minus I sine phi on 2 and the Pauli matrix corresponding to the axis of rotation. So let's think about what this state is doing, what this noise is doing. So the input state is this guy. And then after we apply the noise, it shortens the vector in a particular way so that it lies here along some line joining these two possible states. So can you think about how you would decompose this effect in terms of rotations? So let's say two possible rotations with different probabilities. My Bloch sphere is getting kind of busy, so it'll be hard for me to draw. But maybe if I use my arms, it'll work. So let's say, okay, this is the vector psi 1. And now if I rotate with probability a half, I rotate by some angle like that. And with probability a half, I rotate by some angle like that. And then draw a line between those two. It'll be exactly the same effect as drawing a line between these two points. So we can decompose this the action of this map into an equal mixture of rotations by some angle phi in one direction or the other. So we could rewrite the map as psi of rho. Equals a rotation about the z-axis by some angle alpha. Plus a half rotation about the z-axis by the opposite angle minus alpha. Okay. And this is equal to that. So they're equal when P is equal to sine squared alpha on 2. So you need to get the angle right in order to have the correct effect. Okay, and so this preferred decomposition into rotations about the z-axis might give us some clues about what could be a different strategy that we could use. So our original strategy was to measure along this axis to see, to try and distinguish these two states. While now, if we're thinking about the noise as being some rotations, maybe we can think about making a measurement along this axis. And then, depending on the outcome we get, rotate the state back either in this direction or in that direction. So I'm just going to propose a set of measurement operators that do that. And then later, we'll try and derive how you would implement them. So possible control strategy is to find which direction the noise rotated the state. But we don't want to make a projective measurement, because if we make a projective measurement onto this axis, it's going to kill the distinguishability between these two states. So if we make a projective in this measurement in this axis and get outcome that, then both of those states are going to collapse onto this state. So when I then rotate it back to this plane, it's going to completely ruin the distinguishability. So what we want to do is kind of do a weak measurement, like the one that we discussed yesterday, which gives you a little bit of information about which direction that the noise rotated the state in, and disturbs the state a little bit. So it's going to kill the distinguishability between these a little bit, not kill it, but just reduce the distinguishability a little bit, but it won't completely collapse them onto the same plane. So the measurements, yesterday the scheme that I described, which consisted of bringing in the scintilla, doing a unitary operation, and then measuring in the projective basis, I could rewrite that in terms of these measurement operators. So I'll have two measurement operators, M0 and M1. And they are parametrized by this cosine chi on 2. And Okay, so maybe I can quickly just draw how that looked. I think I had the state, the input state, and then some ancilla 0, 0. I had some unitary that depended on chi, and then I made a projective measurement here. And then this entire thing was the weak measurement. And that weak measurement is given by these these measurement operators. So let's just look at a few limiting cases. So, well, chi here is going to range between 0 and pi on 2. So if chi equals 0, then our measurement operators are just going to be projectors onto the y-axis. And if chi equals pi on 2, then our measurement operators will actually be the same, and they will be proportional to the identity. So you can hopefully kind of see that when chi equals 0, we're just doing a projective measurement, which is going to destroy the distinguishability between these two. And for chi equals pi on 2, we're doing nothing. The measurement gives us no information because the outcomes are the same. And it's not going to affect the distinguishability between these two. Okay, so now we've got our measurement operators. Let's compute the effect of the control scheme. Okay, so let's try and get this through. Okay, so given outcome zero, then we rotate the state by some angle, which we will determine. And given outcome 1, we will rotate the state along the z-axis by the same angle, but in the opposite direction. So we can write down the map for the entire control procedure. So I'm going to do this for just an arbitrary input state. So we're going to have two situations. Given outcome 1, we'll do this. Given outcome 1, we'll do that. So we'll have two terms for our map. So first, we will say S is equal to 1 or 2. We make a measurement corresponding to these operators. So given outcome 0, the post-measurement state is going to be M0 dagger divided by the probability of getting outcome 0. And then we're going to apply the rotation z eta z dagger. And that's going to happen with probability 0. And we can do the same thing for the other term. So given outcome 1, we're going to update the state according to these measurement operators. And then we have to divide by the probability. Then we apply a rotation in the other direction. And this whole thing happens with probability 1. And so you can see that the probabilities are going to cancel. And so then the whole map will be given by this. So here's an example of where you can actually write down a Krauss decomposition for more than just a transformation. You can write down the, more than just a simple transformation, you can write down the Krauss decomposition for an entire control strategy, which then becomes useful if you're going to try and optimize over parameters and so on. Okay, so we now know how to compute our output state using this new control strategy. And then to characterize how well that control strategy worked, we want to compute the average fidelity. And this thing is actually like, very time consuming to compute, so I will again just give you the result, but I'll show you how you would compute it. So our quantum control strategy is going to be the average fidelity of between the input state and the output state, which is given by our map. That's not right. Okay, I have some typos in my notes, so let's just make sure that's correct. Yeah, so we have our input state and computed between the output state, which is given by the map acting on, I guess this should be the noisy qubit, yeah, so that's fine, plus a half psi 2, the quantum control strategy on the noisy state psi 2. Okay, and then I will just give you the output. Oh, okay, and actually, what do I want to say? So this output is going to be a function of a bunch of parameters, which, so what will it depend on? It'll depend on the angle theta, which parametrizes the input states. It'll depend on the noise parameter, and it'll depend on the measurement strength chi, and it'll depend on the correction angle eta. So it's going to be some big function. But since in the lab, we can control these parameters chi, so that's our measurement strength, and we can control the parameter eta, which is this angle of rotation. So what we would like to do is just to optimize the result over these two parameters. Optimize. And if you go ahead and do that, then you will get a optimal quantum control fidelity, which will be 1/2 plus 1/2 So it might not be obvious just by looking at it, but it turns out that this is always going to be greater than what we got for the classical strategy, for the optimal classical. And so I have some plots showing these two things where it becomes quite obvious that that's the case. But since we're running out of time, I'm not going to show them to you on my laptop because it takes a while for the screen to come down, but I'll just send you the paper that has these in it. But the punchline here is that using this alternate, you want to ask?
It's greater, the quantum control is greater?
Yes, very good, yes. The punchline is that using these weak measurements, you can come up with a control strategy that for all possible states parameterized by theta is going to perform with a higher fidelity than this optimal classical strategy. And yeah.
So, I don't understand why it doesn't depend on key, on chi.
Mm. It does. But what I've done here is optimized.
Oh.
So for each theta and p, I can pick an optimal chi and eta, because that's what I can do in the control in the lab. So there'll always be some lab setting where I can get this to perform better than that. And in fact, you can also show that this corresponds to the optimal control strategy that that you could do for this particular scenario. Okay, so just quickly, I wanted to, you can't do this quickly. Okay, what I'm going to do is I will ask Maita if she will be kind enough to let me put a bonus question on today's tutorial, which will exactly walk you through the steps for deriving those measurement operators for that quantum control scheme. So from that picture. So, I mean, for you, it should only take like 5 to 10 minutes to do it by hand, but if I do it on the board, it'll take some while. So that's kind of all I wanted to say today, I think. We have 5 more minutes, so I can answer some more questions. This is going to be the last time that I see you before I hand you over to the capable hands of Maita. She's going to cover some different material. But I will see you on the last tutorial for like next Friday when we do some practice for the interviews. But do you have any questions about the whole course or the stuff we talked about?
I find it difficult to see why we can distinguish something that is on one and something that is on two with a measurement that is done in this plane.
Yeah.
Is there a way to?
Yeah, it's weird. So in fact, the measurement doesn't distinguish between these two states at all, which is kind of the neat thing here, that the control strategy works without anyone ever getting information about which of these two states was prepared. And it works equally on both of those states. But the intuition for why it works, you can kind of think about it as, okay, ignore like the decompositions into flips or rotations, but just think about what is the effect on this vector. So it's doing two things. One is that the length of the vector is getting shorter, and the other thing is that the angle from the plane is getting larger. So what you want is some map that is going to counteract those things. So you want that map to lengthen the vector, so to undo the fact that it got shorter, and you want the map to reduce this angle to counteract the fact that it got greater. And so it turns out that this, so if I have these two states, then, and I do this weak measurement, well, the strongest version of that measurement is to do this. Well, it's to project onto that axis. So you can imagine what it's doing in between is it's lengthening these vectors as you're rotating, and it's bringing them closer together. And it doesn't really matter whether it does it in this direction or in that direction. In both cases, it lengthens it and brings them closer together. But then you have to undo the fact that it also rotates it. But because you know which way it rotated it, you have that information to rotate it back. I don't know if that is convincing. But the way to think about it is that the measurement is fixing the effect of the noise, but it's introducing some random rotation. And then the fix just fixes that rotation introduced by the measurement. But the fix itself doesn't fix what the noise is doing. So yeah, maybe we can chat about that more as well. And actually, yeah, more generally, I'm going to be around here. So if you guys have any more questions about the material we covered in this part of the course or the homework, just feel free to drop by my office and I'm happy to answer them. And yeah, so thank you very much.